From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the March edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we hear from some of the veterans who met Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cornwall when she came to Bletchley Park to learn about the contribution women here made to the war effort. We'll bring you reaction from senior cryptographer Captain Jerry Roberts after he met Her Majesty the Queen for the second time as he received his MBE at Buckingham Palace. We'll look ahead at some spring events, and we'll hear from Bletchley Park guide and historian Joel Greenberg about his new biography of Gordon Welshman. First, everyone was feeling the love on Valentine's Day when Digital Radio UK came to the National Radio Centre at Bletchley Park to switch 1.8 million local radio listeners onto DAB across Beds, Hearts and Bucks. As the excitement was building, I spoke to Ford Ennells.
My name is Ford Ennells. I'm Chief Executive of Digital Radio UK, and we're the organisation responsible for developing and launching digital radio so it's available throughout the UK. This is part of a rollout of local radio onto DAB, on digital radio. So right now there are national services available in sort of almost about 90% of the country, but in locally it's only available in about 60%. So we're working with government to extend from 60% of the country to 90%, and there's a series of 13 area launches, and this is the biggest single area launch that's going to happen in the UK over the next 3 years. And almost 2 million people will be able to receive local DAB today as a result of these transmitters being switched on.
So just remind me, what area this covers?
People from the Hertfordshire, Bedfordshire and Buckinghamshire areas, Milton Keynes, obviously Bletchley, but you know, Stevenage and Hitchin and Aylesbury down to St Albans. So it's a big, big area, and a lot of people will, I think, enjoy the fact they can now get their local services on DAB.
It makes for a strange local radio area being sort of in the commuter belt, doesn't it, where you look towards London. Perhaps a lot of people live in these areas and work in London. So it's a strange market to compete in for local radio, isn't it?
It's an important market because there's lots of people here. But you're right, a lot of people will travel into London, and some people will be on the fringes of London coverage and be able to pick up the London stations. But, you know, people really like the local stations. People like to get local news and information about where they live. I mean, today, launching on DAB is MKFM, so Milton Keynes' own radio station. So ultra-local stations with an ultra-local perspective. And people haven't been able to get that before, and now they will. Heart, Capital and Gold and BBC Three Counties are all part of the launch today. The big groups are committed to local radio. They are trying to deliver it in a more efficient way. But it's also great because we are seeing extra local stations come on board as well. And we're seeing two today across Hearts, Beds and Bucks, Connect FM and MKFM, and that's great news.
Yes, so we welcome them because I think there is a real appetite for local information, like you say. Great news today, and welcome to Bletchley Park.
Thank you. It's great to be in Bletchley Park, and what a great place to have the launch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The big green button was pressed by the MK Dons chairman, Pete Winkleman, and the MP for Milton Keynes South, Ian Stewart.
We have a countdown. I'm going to ask people to join in at that point, if you can both hit the button, and we'll then ask the signals to be switched on, and hopefully we'll be able to get it on this radio here.
Hello there, my digital brothers and sisters. It's time to make the switch a reality. Are you ready?
The third Enigma Challenge approaches from the 14th to the 17th of March. This time, the GCHQ team sending Enigma encrypted messages will be at the Big Bang Fair, an event aimed at young scientists and engineers at Excel in London. We're in for an exciting Easter at Bletchley Park. Sorry, I had to be done. With events coming up for all ages. The Bletchley Park Trust's events manager, Claire Irwin, told me what's coming up. So what's happening at Easter?
We've got our annual Easter extravaganza. It's basically an Easter egg trail around the entire park, but also learning interesting facts about Bletchley Park. At the end, obviously, you get your chocolatey prize.
So you have to stock up on quite a large number of chocolate eggs then, and presumably keep staff and visitors away from them until the key moment.
I have them locked up in the kitchen at the other side of the site.
Word of advice, don't tell people where you hide them.
Okay.
We've also got, coming up in a few days in fact, the Battle of the Atlantic, a day-long event of talks.
As you say, we've got three very eminent speakers who'll be looking into the facts, but they'll be specifically looking at the intelligence connected with it. One in particular I'm looking forward to is Ince McCartney. He's an archaeologist and he looks at the archaeology of the sunken ships and connects that to the intelligence we have gathered here at Bletchley Park. The speakers will be talking based on first-hand evidence and information that actually hasn't been brought into the public domain before.
He's investigated shipwrecks for his career, hasn't he?
Absolutely, he's a marine archaeologist.
So who are the other speakers?
We have WJR, otherwise known as Jock Gardner. He's served in the Royal Navy for 30 years and actually specialises in anti-submarine warfare. And Malcolm Lauren Jones also has a Royal Navy background, but also a background in mathematics, hence his interest in particularly Bletchley Park and the intelligence gathered.
So even if you're not a naval buff, there's a fascinating slice of history there for you.
I think so. I think it's making what happened here at Bletchley Park and the information gathered and actually what happened and how it affected people's lives, which I think often is forgotten about Bletchley Park. Everything that happened here affected someone's life some way or the other.
The largely unknown story of one of Bletchley Park's less celebrated geniuses is being told in a new biography by a Bletchley Park historian and tour guide. Joel Greenberg says codebreaker Gordon Welshman was always ahead of his time and was one of the first to see the bigger picture at Bletchley Park. First of all, how long have you been researching Gordon Welshman?
I started it probably at the end of 2010. I became a volunteer here in the middle of 2010 and then started thinking about it. So probably full-time, actually seriously doing it, about 2 years.
What got you interested in him in particular?
Well, in 1982, I bought a book called The Hut Six Story. I'd read a lot of books about Bletchley Park and was following the story, came across his book. It was a challenging read, and because Welshman had been mentioned in other books that I'd read, but they'd never given the impression that he was anything other than just somebody else here. And here was this book where this chap was saying he had done this and he had done that. And I actually thought he sounded a bit arrogant, and I was quite surprised by it. But it was one of those books that intrigued me, and I always knew where it was in the house and kept on coming back to it and that. And it was only when I got involved as a volunteer at Bletchley Park and started talking with colleagues that, you know, had been following the story that I suddenly realised that he actually had done all of this stuff. That was my initial interest, and the fact that nobody had heard of him I found quite surprising.
It's quite an intriguing notion that somebody could have written a book on claiming all sorts of Bletchley Park-based glory that wasn't actually true, because the records aren't there to check against.
Well, it was more the fact that the story behind it, the fact that until he wrote the Hut Six story, which came out, he started it in 74, but it came out in 82. That was the first book which actually explained how they did it. All the other books told the story about Bletchley Park, the fact that messages were decrypted on an industrial scale and all this intelligence produced, lots of information about how it affected the outcome of World War II, but nobody was allowed or dared describe the process how they actually did it. Welshman's book was the first, and interestingly enough, it probably remains the only serious book in print to describe technically how the bomb worked and how Enigma messages were decrypted on an industrial scale. There are references to it in other books, but not the detail that Welshman went into.
And did he get himself into bother for revealing this kind of detail?
Yes, he did. I mean, he had immigrated to the United States after the war. He became an American citizen in the early 1960s. So he thought he was immune for prosecution anyway. It would be pointless trying to pursue it through the National Security Agency of the United States. He couldn't get a view from them. He knew the GCHQ weren't keen, and if he asked GCHQ, they would say no. But he had other drivers for wanting to do it. It wasn't an ego trip, and it wasn't, I can make a lot of money. He had two drivers. The first was he was actually working as a consultant for the American military. He was a consultant for something called the MITRE Corporation, which was a big research institute, a spinoff from MIT. So he was advising on putting in place secure tactical communication systems for the American Air Force. And he felt that they were making, and NATO more generally was making, the same mistakes that the Germans had made in World War II in securing their tactical communications. And interesting enough, the people in MITRE agreed, and they were keen on him to tell a story because they thought it would help inform their own work as well. So he was being encouraged to do it by colleagues in the United States. The other driver was the fact that so many of the people who had been involved, particularly, you know, he was 33 at the beginning of World War II, which was middle-aged in Bletchley Park terms. They were all so young. He'd recruited a lot of former students, and he found some of his colleagues who had been recruited, their families had almost disowned them. He'd had one guy who he'd recruited from Cambridge who'd received a letter from the headmaster of a school, more or less accusing him of treason and saying that he was a disgrace to the school and stuff like that. And he just felt that their story should be told and people should be aware. Even if he didn't physically name them or quote them, people would be more aware of the amazing things that these people did.
And it throws light back on what it must have been like for those 30 years that nothing could be said for people who'd achieved incredible things here. And like you say, even perceived to be cowards even.
Yeah. Welchman himself had that experience because his first wife, her family were senior military figures, and they were very disapproving of him because here was this man in his early 30s, not in uniform. So what was he doing? Some admin job? And there were many people at Bletchley Park who had that same problem. John Harrowville, who Welchman had recruited from Cambridge, who became famous for something called the Harrowville tip, a technique that was used quite effectively here at one point in the early part of the war. According to Harrowville's own account in a book he wrote, he'd fallen out with his father over it and apparently had been tempted to tell his father when his father was dying, but it was still before the books had been published, and in the end couldn't bring himself. So his father died not knowing what his son had achieved. And so there's a lot of stories like that.
Tell me, what kind of approach does your book take? Is it quite technical, or is it about the man himself?
It's a biography of Welchman, given that I think some people who would read a biography of Gordon Welchman would expect there to be some detail. What I've done is I've put all of the technical stuff in appendices. In particular, there's quite a detailed technical appendix about Enigma and the bomb. I've been very fortunate that Frank Carter, who's I regard as one of the world's leading experts in this stuff, has written quite a detailed appendix with a nice pun, Enigma and the bomb in depth, sort of slight pun on the cryptographic term, a depth. And there's a lot of quite detailed information about the workings of Enigma and the bomb machine. But the general book itself, hopefully, is readable and accessible. No, it is a biography. It's his entire life. It does not just stick to the wartime period. It's a complete his entire life from birth to death.
Must have been quite some research. You've got to know his family quite well, haven't you?
Yes, I was quite fortunate. I mean, that was my starting point. I was able to make contact with the family through a gentleman called Mark Baldwin. Mark republished the Hut 6 story in 1997. I assumed he'd made contact with the family to get permission to do that. Welchman himself had died in 85. And Mark put me in touch with Welchman's son, Nick Welchman. And then he eventually wrote and said, yeah, they were very keen on the idea. I eventually went over there and met Nick and his sister, Roz. There's a third sister, Sue, who I've corresponded with and interviewed on the phone. I haven't actually physically met her, but I have talked to her on a number of occasions as well. Nick was very, very keen to support the project because he wanted, because of the restrictions placed on Welchman when he wrote the Hut 6 story, government could not prevent publication, both in the United States or the UK. But what the American authorities did was they prevented him from promoting the book at all. They put all sorts of restrictions on him. He couldn't even speak in public about anything to do with Enigma or the technologies. And so that obviously adversely affected sales of the book. So I think the family felt if this was done, then if it was properly promoted, that finally his story would be told to a wider audience.
So he was allowed to publish it, but then stifled to do anything to promote it. That must have been really difficult.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the views of the authorities has just, funnily, just in time before my book goes to press, come out. There was a classified document just released January 1st, which is an internal cabinet memo from the cabinet secretary to the prime minister of the day, Margaret Thatcher, April 82, explaining to her that this book, Hut 6 story, has been published by Gordon Welchman, what the view of the American authorities is and what the position is in the United Kingdom. So we now know at least part of what the government's thinking was at that time.
Have any idea how she reacted?
What was being presented to her was that the advice that the cabinet secretary had was that the book had already been published in the United States. The American authorities had decided that it was pointless trying to prosecute him, that the secretary of the D-Notice Committee had spoken to the British publishers, Alan Lane, expressing concern, but they had still intended to publish, and the advice was that it's unlikely they could legally stop them from publishing it. The reaction of the Prime Minister is interesting. There's a handwritten note on this memo with her initials under it, which simply said, "Who are the publishers?"
I wonder what went on after that.
Not much, really. I mean, interesting enough, even though Welchman was, you know, really had a lot of difficulty with both the American authorities, he had FBI agents parked outside of his house, phone was tapped, apparently, he believed. He certainly had various interviews and, you know, quite aggressive communications from them. He only ever had two communications from GCHQ. He had one very early on when he'd made early inquiries about the possibilities of writing a book, and then he had quite an aggressive letter from Sir Peter Mary Church that he had at GCHQ in 1985, and those are the only two pieces of correspondence he ever received after the war from GCHQ.
And when's the book come out then?
October this year. Doing the fun bits now, picking photographs, just waiting for, there's a peer reviewer who's got a few comments, but it's unlikely the text will change now. So yeah, work's underway in designing the cover. And so I don't know, maybe 2013 will be Gordon Welchman year. There's a theatre company putting on a play which has Welchman as the key figure. We're hoping, as part of redoing the interpretation of the key figures at Bletchley Park, to put on some sort of a Welchman exhibition. I mean, the family have been very generous, because a lot of my research is based on new source material, huge amounts of Welchman's personal papers and correspondence, which his son had kept since 1985, had it all stored in his loft, and they've given it all to Bletchley Park, me initially, signed over copyright, his OBE, and all sorts of other stuff. And the idea is, when I'm finished with it, it'll go into the Bletchley Park archive. It's always dangerous to, you know, say who is more important than who in Bletchley Park, because there are an awful lot of important people, and obviously Alan Turing tends to dominate the stage, so to speak, and has done for a number of years. In the end, if pressed, the way I tend to think of it is that of all the people, Turing and Welchman were fundamental to Bletchley Park's success.
I look forward to reading it. Thank you.
Thanks.
MC Fontaine here, and I'm sat with who I thought was just Bletchley Park's media manager and Bletchley Park's podcast presenter, Catherine Lynch, but it would appear that you have a new role as Bletchley Park royal correspondent.
February the 28th was an incredible day. I went to Buckingham Palace. I was very kindly invited by Captain Jerry Roberts and his wife May on what turned out to be not only the day he met the Queen for the second time and received his MBE, but also their 21st wedding anniversary.
That must have been a real honour.
It was breathtaking. Each recipient gets to take three guests along to the investiture ceremony, and it's all pomp and ceremony to the absolute max. You are told where to sit, where to stand, exactly how to behave. No phones on, no cameras inside the palace. But do you know what? That makes you concentrate on looking at your surroundings and actually taking it in a way that we don't, I think, when we're sort of constantly accompanied by electronic devices.
Yeah, we get too distracted, don't we,
yeah,
by,
we're so busy
our toys,
tweeting about something or texting someone or taking a picture. We're not actually sitting looking at it. It's a powerful set of memories because you're able to just absorb it all visually and listen to it. There was a live orchestra in the balcony above in the ballroom, and we were on benches all around three sides of the room, and at the front it was all set up for Her Majesty to come, and there's a throne. She didn't sit on it, she just put a handbag on it for the length of the ceremony. And she stood throughout and she spoke individually to each recipient. And I mean, there were more than 100. Jerry was in some quite exalted company that day. Perhaps none, you know, more so than he. But Sherry Blair, several Olympians, including Jessica Ennis, Greg Rutherford, who's from these parts originally, and cyclist Joanna Rousell. But most were people who will be quite well known in their local communities, but not outside of them. They're for charity work. So it was humbling and powerful. And when Jerry's moment came, he had been in a wheelchair for most of the day, because let's not forget he's 92. But of course, he wanted to stand to meet Her Majesty. And he wasn't alone in that. There were a couple of other people of quite an advanced age receiving honours who did the same. And it was quite moving.
It's that generation wanting to show respect for the monarch, isn't it,
yes.
I suppose?
Well, they're all told exactly what to do. So take three steps forward, bow or curtsy to Her Majesty, receive your honour, take three steps backwards, bow or curtsy again, and then you make your exit. And it's all very choreographed. They're told exactly where to stand, exactly what to do, even which direction to look in. So nobody else hears the conversation that each person has with Her Majesty. And they will give you varying accounts of how much they can remember, because it's such a big moment in everyone's life to whom that happens, that the adrenaline must be incredible.
You got a bit of an insight from Jerry on what the Queen actually did say to him.
Over lunch in Chinatown, yes we did. So tell me, what did the Queen say to you, Jerry?
She said, "I remember you. We met at Bletchley Park." And I said, "Yes, that was a red letter day for us. You were so charming and interested. I talked about the tunny machine because we were standing over a tunny machine. And she asked 4 or 5 questions, and always with that beautiful, warm and friendly smile. We must have talked for 6 or 7 minutes.
How do you feel now about today?
I felt that I was standing in representing the other people in the testry who worked with me, especially the cryptographers.
Did you think about your colleagues when you, in that moment, when you actually walked up to meet the Queen?
No. It's so personal.
Yeah.
You and her. If she was an ordinary person, it wouldn't make much difference. But she's not an ordinary person. Someone very special. I tell everybody about it because I've always been a royalist.
What do you think you remember most about today?
Just the 2 or 3 with Her Majesty. You know.
Don't get many chances
to the rest
to
of it, it's all rather long-winded. It took rather a long time.
There's a lot of people to get through.
Yes.
Thank you again for allowing me to be here. It's a great honour.
You're extremely welcome.
But you've not just been hobnobbing with the Queen down at the palace, have you?
No. Her Royal Highness, the Duchess of Cornwall, came to Bletchley Park the week before I went to Buckingham Palace. She came to visit lots of veterans, all women, all from the local area, who had been part of the operation both here and at the outstations of Bletchley Park.
I think Camilla spent a lot of time with each group, didn't she?
She was really attentive. She really took her time. She was fascinated to hear what they had to say. She was asking them about their experiences here and about their time during the war. She sat down at each table, which had, I think, 6 veterans at each. Now, obviously, not every single lady got to talk to her, but they all got that close-up, personal encounter with royalty, which is really special, and it's a real one-off moment for them. It was an honour to be part of it.
I saw you fleetingly during the day a few times.
I was probably visible as a fast-travelling blue coat with some hair flying out behind, because I did not touch the same piece of carpet for more than about 3 seconds, I don't think. It was fantastic. We had such a great turnout from the media. We had Hello Magazine, The Times Royal Correspondent, British Forces Broadcasting Service, which broadcasts to people in the forces all around the world. We had ITV and the Press Association, whose pictures just go worldwide. And we had some photogenic artefacts for the Duchess to handle. And she met a woman who'd worked in Hut 8 with Alan Turing and was told about the Enigma machine and Alan Turing's teddy bear, Porgy, which we have in the museum.
I worked in Hut 8 when Alan Turing was the head of the section, and you get the messages coming out in German and positions of U-boats. Off it would go to Admiralty, and the next thing you'd hear of was a U-boat being sunk. It was quite nerve-wracking. Time was of essence, very much so in those days.
Aileen Hasdell. I worked for Y Group. We fed Bletchley Park with coded messages. There would have been no reason for Bletchley Park to be here without these messages that we intercepted. And they were all in code, German coded messages. And I used to wonder whether they were any good, because, of course, you had to take these messages down through terrible interference, and you wouldn't always get a complete message. They were always came over in blocks of 5 letters, 5 Morse code letters. And you may not have got them all. And I used to think, what good is this? But we had stations all over the country. So say I got 2 letters out of a group of 5. Somebody else might have picked up the other 3. So when they came back to Bletchley Park, they had to sort all this sort of rubbish out and get it into some sort of order and then start decoding.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening.
It was very pleasant. She's a very pleasant lady, I must say. And I felt that I wasn't doing all the right mams and what have you in the right places. I just spoke to her as normal. It just seemed to flow quite easily. I was just telling her what I did during the war and where I'd been.
Well, I was a bomb operator at Eastcote on Sea Watch. The machines never stopped. They went for 24 hours. You had to work in shifts, 8-hour shifts, which meant sometimes you were working all night. 3 watches, and the other watch was on leave. Sea Watch was actually on duty when they announced VE Day. So it stopped the following day. The chief officer gave us all a little pep talk. Well, I think she thought we were all going to lose our honour because of everybody feeling free and throwing away caution to the winds and celebrating and drinking. She was, poor woman. It's been terrible for her. And we all rushed up to London and throwing the crowds there outside the palace, shouting and marching them down Piccadilly with about 20 Canadian Air Force officers all arm in arm. Had a marvellous day. And then we slept in the YWCA, came back to Eastcote the next day. And it must have been the following day then that we then sat outside. There was a heat wave. Sat outside and smashed up the bombs. Well, didn't actually smash them. The Air Force boys, who were GCHQ engineers, they had dismantled the big things and we had all the small stuff and all these hundreds of drums to take them apart. Everything was counted, screws and bearings and so on.
Did that make you feel, oh, what have we been doing?
No, that made we were all happy. That was it, it was the end of it.
Peggy Dorrington.
I'm Alma Whiteman. We were in Hut 7 of Roxy, where we worked on shifts 9 to 4. Then the next week was 4 to midnight, and the next week was midnight to 9 in the morning. You just worked all the time you were there. What about you?
Well, I think I've discovered I'm able to talk about the fact that we worked Hollerith machines.
We were both local. I was recruited by other people from my school who were already here. Recommendation, shall we say?
Yes, I lived at Leighton Buzzard, so I was able to live at home. But I was recruited by someone who was working at Bletchley Park.
They didn't advertise publicly.
No, he was quietly recruiting around the area, you know, and one word led to another, so to speak. I was already working in a solicitor's office in Leighton Buzzard, and this person actually met my husband, my boyfriend at the time, who was home on leave from the RAF. They were playing billiards and obviously got talking about what I was going to be doing during the war, because we were getting the call-up age. And between them, they decided it might be a good idea if I applied to Bletchley Park.
You only went to your own rooms in your own block. You didn't really move about within that very much.
Do you have fond memories of your time here?
Definitely.
Never unhappy?
No.
Tired.
Well, we were so young, you just enjoyed life when you could.
It's a bit of my life I wouldn't want to have missed, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Thank you very much.
She obviously wanted to know about my uncle and the family connection. It's a shame because he died before I was born. I couldn't really give her any sort of great insights, you know, just family stories, really.
And what's it like for you with your family connection to see all these veterans back at Bletchley Park today and her visit? How does it feel for you?
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, these people are quite extraordinary and they all did amazing things. Some of the things they did were mind-numbingly boring, and they're all so positive about it, and they're also very interesting about having to keep the vow of silence after the war had ended, and they also talk about the naughty things they got up to in their spare time. So it's really been fun, actually. It's been a great day.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.